Welcome to the MLB Trade Rumors Podcast.
Hello, and welcome to another episode of the MLB Trade Rumors Podcast. My name is Dara McDonald of MLB Trade Rumors, recently acquired for a podcaster to be named later. We are going to talk about the goings-on in baseball. With me to go over it all is my colleague, Anthony Franco. How are you, Anthony?
I'm good, Dara. How you been?
I'm doing great, thanks. I'm feeling much more well-rested now that I got some space between us and the trade deadline. How about yourself? Are you feeling like more, got some vitality back? Did you sleep okay?
Yeah, pretty well rested. What's it been, 2 weeks? That's enough time to have a relaxing August and then, you know, in the next couple of weeks start to work on upcoming offseason.
Absolutely. We're going to be getting the top 50 going and the positional previews and the offseason outlooks and all the sort of offseason-y stuff that we do. That'll all be coming up. For now, it's August and there's still the 2023 season to deal with. So we'll be talking about that. The first thing I want to talk about, though, is an interesting sort of thing because, you know, the trade deadline and the trade rumors, that's sort of our bailiwick here. And it seems there has been some talk of moving the trade deadline to the middle of August from the end of July. So I'll sort of try to quickly lay out the argument here. John Shea had a piece in the Chronicle where he laid out the reasons why people want to move it. Now, to be clear, there's nothing to indicate that there's like serious talks about it, like it's imminent change, but it's just something that people are thinking about discussing. So here are the arguments for it that he laid out. He pointed out that when the first time the trade deadline was put at the end of July was in, I think it was 1986, some point in the 80s anyway. And at that time, there were only four playoff spots for 26 teams. So it was very easy to figure out if you were a buyer or seller at that time. Now, of course, there are 12 playoff spots for 30 teams. And so as we saw this year, the trade deadline was sort of, you know, there was a lot of theoretical deals that didn't come together, teams that could have sold but didn't, decided to stand pat because they had kind of a chance. So sort of, you know, the argument would be that you give teams a little bit more time to sort of suss that out because it's not as clear as it used to be. The other argument is that they used to have, up until 2019, there was also the second trade deadline, the waiver deadline. Revocable waiver deadline. So that's still through the month of August, you still kind of had a way to add an impact player. It was a little bit harder and it was convoluted with the whole waiver process, if you remember how that went down. But still, even though it was convoluted, you know, you could still have like a Justin Verlander or a Josh Donaldson. Significant players could still move in the month of August. And furthermore, the draft used to be in June, and Major League Baseball has tried to have it coincide with the All-Star game now as part of like the All-Star Week festivities. So now it's in the middle of July. And so now front offices are really focused on the draft until the middle of July. And now they have basically like 2 weeks just to do deadline stuff from the middle of July to the end of July. And so all of these arguments are for pushing it to like a compromise because, you know, there used to be the end of July deadline and the end of August deadline. Now we only have one deadline, but maybe it should be in the middle of August between where the other two deadlines used to be. And of course, the implications of this would be significant, as we've seen in the standings. But anyway, before we get into specifics, do you have any initial thoughts, feelings on this, Anthony?
Well, I don't feel strongly about it necessarily either way, although I will say that of the kind of three arguments that Shea laid out and that you just summarized, I think the draft one is the one that I find most compelling. You know, I hated the revocable trade waiver system. I'm glad that's gone. As far as the giving front offices more time to make the decision, like, you know, you're at about 100 games by the start of August. If the team is hovering around 500 or barely above 500 and you can't really tell whether you're a contender or not yet, then that to me is sort of like, I don't feel a ton of sympathy for those teams. Like, I get that it's a kind of tough situation and you'll have to make a decision based on kind of a small sample of games leading up to the deadline, but you've had a lot of time for the roster that theoretically you put together to sort of separate itself from the pack, and it hasn't done it. And so the idea that like, oh, well, we need to give front offices more time to make decisions, I don't know about that. But I do think that the draft argument that, yeah, okay, the draft used to be in June, they pushed it back to July, which doesn't seem great for kind of anyone in the scouting community, but like you said, sort of lines up, at least in a way that MLB thinks is better for marketing purposes, because it's around the All-Star break. You know, that takes a lot of focus from front offices and staffs. And you hear that a lot sort of in early July, where there's like questions about why isn't the trade market moving? And the general answer among front office people tends to be, yeah, well, we're all focused on the draft. And once that ends, we can turn our attention to the trade market. And so kind of creating that month-long gap between the draft and the deadline that has sort of been there for a while, and just changed over the last couple of years, I think is the best argument for pushing the deadline back.
It's interesting that you point, like, yes, front offices should, like, I'm not trying to say that these poor front offices, they need more time to figure out where they are in the standings. But I also think, like, there's an argument to be made from trades are part of the entertainment product of baseball now. Like, that's kind of our wheelhouse. You know, like, people presumably come to MLB Trade Rumors because they like trades and they want trades to happen. So what we saw this most recent deadline is not a lot of trades happened. You know, the Angels held on to Otani, and then the Cubs held on to like Bellinger and Stroman. And, you know, there's plenty of other teams who might have approached the trade deadline differently if they had an extra couple weeks. So it's not so much about sympathy for front offices necessarily, but just by moving it back, you might get more separation from the contenders and the pretenders, and then more trades would happen. I mean, the Angels are the most obvious example because they, you know, had a bit of a hot streak before the deadline and had something. They still had a long shot, but it was something like, I don't know, like 15% playoff odds, something like that at Fangraphs. So they held on to Otani and they got Giolito and a bunch of other guys. Now, a couple weeks later, they're down to, geez, what is it, like 1% something? Hold on, I got it up here. Yeah, 1.1% on Fangraphs now because they've been ice cold the past couple weeks. So, you know, if the trade deadline were this week instead of 2 weeks ago, we would probably have more exciting stuff. You know, Otani would be on the block. You know, maybe the Yankees decide to sell and then Harrison Bader is available, or, you know, something like that. So do you think that's compelling at all, that just like in terms of excitement, it would be better for the league and the product?
I think it would have been better this year, for sure, because of, as you mentioned, Otani, and I think San Diego would probably be in a different position as well with Hader and Snell. But I don't know that that's something you can necessarily count on every year, right? Like if the Angels had played terribly in the last 2 weeks of July and then gotten hot the first couple of weeks of August, and you push the deadline back to August 15th, then you could sort of make the same argument like, oh, well, maybe the Angels would squint and Artie Moreno be like, well, we're playing better now, we got a chance, we're hot, maybe we should keep Otani and go for it, sort of thing, you know. So obviously the later in the season you go in general, the more stratified kind of the playoff odds will be, just because there's less time for teams to make up a gap in the standings. But I think sort of no matter where you set it, you're going to have teams that are kind of on the border and don't really have a strong, I guess, opinion on where they should go. Like, I think Seattle would sort of be the counter argument this year, right? Like, they moved Seawald. They didn't sell, but they moved Seawald for a couple of controllable hitters, and they at least listened to offers on Teoscar. And over the last couple of weeks, they've gotten hot. And so if they were two games back on July 31st, maybe they don't trade Paul Seawald, you know? So I think anywhere that you set it, you're going to have teams that are kind of making tough decisions because they're sort of right on that bubble.
Right, right. Interesting stuff. Well, it'll be fascinating to follow and see if there is any momentum towards movement there. I mean, you're right that there are always bubble teams, but I think it is like it's sort of difficult to find the sweet spot, because if you push it later, then yes, more teams will sort of become more clearly out of it and their odds will drop. But also at the same time, you don't want it to be like, you don't want trades, you don't want Otani to be traded on like the last day of the season or something like that. So there has to be a line somewhere. So that'll be something that, you know, perhaps will change in the years to come. Speaking of decisions to trade or not trade, it was reported on the site this week that the Mets at least dangled Pete Alonso as they, you know, they sold off a lot of pieces that could help them next year. You know, Max Scherzer and Justin Verlander and Mark Canna were all guys who sort of maybe could have been part of the 2024 team, but it seems like the Mets are willing to, I don't know, take a step back, I guess. At least, you know, Steve Cohen said it's probably going to be a less star-studded team 2024. So that leaves the big question of what to do with Pete Alonso, because he has 1 year remaining, 1 year of arbitration control remaining for 2024. So if they are taking a step back, then it seems like they should pick a lane, either trade or extend. Do you have a leaning that you would opt for, Anthony?
Well, I'd mostly agree that, yeah, they should do something this winter. I don't think that they should go into next spring without having a deal in place, or at least some sort of progress on an extension or a potential trade possibility. Like I just going into next year as his final arbitration season, I think would be a mistake. As far as which way it goes, you know, I mean, he's a really good player, right? So, and the Mets have a lot of payroll space. Well, not necessarily payroll space, but a lot of payroll flexibility because of the amount of money that Steve Cohen has. And so you look kind of at, you know, like what kind of money Alonso might be looking at. And to me, I think the Matt Olson deal, which I believe is 168 over eight, is about where I'd line up. On Alonso, maybe a little bit above that because he's a year further into arbitration. But I think they're relatively comparable players. I think Olson's probably a little bit better, but Alonso has kind of the flashier skill set, more obvious raw power, even though Olson's like quietly on like a 60 homer pace. And so I guess, you know, I would lean that way and sort of look, okay, well, are we talking, does Alonso's camp open to something in the Olson range? And at that point, you know, you probably try to get a deal done. If he's trying to go well over 200, pushing $250 million, then okay, I think I would pivot and say, all right, we're gonna put him in the trade market. But I know that you did kind of a longer piece on this for the site last week, sort of looking at the alternatives. So I'm curious where you stand on that.
Yes, I did. Yeah, I think, like you astutely pointed out, the big question is what Alonso's camp. Like, what it would take to get an extension done? Like, that's the major unknown right now. Like, we know the Mets have him for one more year. Arbitration-wise, he'll probably make something in the vicinity of $20 million for that. He would still have plenty of trade value at that price point. By all accounts, he apparently likes New York, says he's willing to stay, all that kind of stuff. So they could get something done. But yeah, the major unknown is what he would want. Joel Sherman had a piece about this at the Post this week. Not like sourced or anything. It seemed like he was just sort of like hypothesizing as to what might be holding up an extension. And he talked a lot about the valuation of first baseman, how, you know, no first baseman is going to get the like Albert Pujols, Miguel Cabrera deal anymore, where you get paid to like 42, your age 42 season or whatever. And he pointed out that like, I think Freeman and Goldschmidt and Olson and all these first basemen, their deals all sort of stopped out at like, you know, age 36 or age 37, something like that. So if, you know, like you said, if Alonso is willing to take the Olson deal where it goes to sort of his like age 37 season or something like that, then sure, yeah, do it. But if he's trying to like maybe get like an Aaron Judge type deal where it's like 9-10 years going into his like late 30s, like almost 40 kind of thing, then you can see why the Mets would balk at that. So, I mean, I could see the argument either way. The Mets seem to have prioritized doing these deals. I didn't think they were going to do the Scherzer deal or the Verlander deal, but they clearly wanted to get these top prospects and were willing to put them out there, even though it's going to hurt their 2024 team. So, I mean, if Cohen's willing to like someday down the line, like put money back on the table and replace anybody that he trades, then sure, why not lean into stocking the farm system now? So I guess I would have a slight lean towards a trade, but again, it depends on his price point and like whether they can find something reasonable on the extension front. Elsewhere in New York, both New York teams are struggling this year. The Yankees have been struggling with rotation health all year. From the beginning, I think Frankie Montas has been out all year. Nestor Cortes has been on and off the IL. He just went back on the IL with a rotator cuff strain. Carlos Rodon has been on the injury list for much of the year, and he's now back there again. Anthony, what do you make of this Yankees rotation?
It looks bad. The offense looks bad. I mean, the team just doesn't look good, right? It's the injuries have kind of devastated the rotation. Like you said, they haven't been helped by the fact that Luis Severino has been awful. You know, I mean, Clark Schmidt has sort of found himself after a tough April, and Garrett Cole's been really good, but the back of that rotation just hasn't performed. And again, it's, you know, when 3/5 of what you anticipated being in that starting staff in March have missed most or all of the season, then sure, you know, it's going to be tough to kind of count on those guys. And then the young players, Randy Vasquez has been okay, and he's had a few starts, but has had just a decent year in AAA. Yanni Brito hasn't been particularly good as a rookie. And so, you know, they're kind of patching things together at the back end. And then they've got a very top heavy lineup that just hasn't performed for a couple months. And, you know, so I don't think it's a coincidence that they've been pretty bad for going on like 2 to 3 months now.
Yeah, playoff odds are down to 5.3% for the Yankees, so it's not great. The rotation, like going forward, it's interesting because, you know, you're going to lose Montas and Severino to free agency, but you weren't getting anything from these guys this year regardless. Like, they've been either hurt or bad. So if everybody's healthy next year, it still seems like it could be a decent rotation. But I guess that's a big if, because so like on paper going into next year, you got Cole, Rodon, Cortez, Schmidt in 4 spots with, you know, a 5 spot available for either Vasquez or Brito. Do you think that they would dedicate significant resources? I mean, there's a lot of starting pitching available this winter. Do you think the Yankees will go after one of those guys?
Yeah, I'd be surprised if they don't sign a starter. Just like you said, there's a lot of the kind of mid-rotation types. You know, I don't know that they would go back to Jordan Montgomery specifically, but there are guys like that out there who I think would fit pretty well, sort of playing the kind of role that they lost last year when they let Jameson Taillon go, where it's just, you know, that stable number 3-4 starter who, you know, I guess you can't count on any starting pitcher to ever give you 30 plus starts because there's injury risk with all of them, but somebody you feel good about being likely to shoulder a pretty strong workload, toss 150, 160 innings with an ERA around 4, something like that, just to give you some kind of stability behind Cole, especially given the injury uncertainty with Rodon and Cortez going into next year.
Yeah, absolutely. That would have made such a huge difference this year. I mean, Severino's just stayed in the rotation despite being terrible, just because they haven't had anybody else that they felt better about, either for health reasons or inexperience reasons or what have you. So, yeah, I think having a solid mid-rotation guy would have been a huge help and will probably be a goal going into the winter.
Let me put you on the spot here. So the Yankees, I believe, haven't had a losing season since 92, I think is the stat. They're going on like 30 years of being above 500, which is insane. I mean, I know that, you know, for most of that time or all of that time, they've had a high payroll, but a lot of clubs have high payrolls and are not good. It's not inherently a guarantee of consistent success. As of recording Tuesday morning, they're 60-59. They've lost 3 in a row. At the end of the season, do you think that streak exists? Are they above 500 by year's end?
Ooh, interesting. I will say, I mean, they're right on the line, so it's a coin toss at this point. I will say they stay above, you know, most of that. I'm wavering as I'm talking. I'm going to say no, just because I feel like at a certain point, even if they're hovering around 500, because they're, at least as of right now, at the back of the AL East, I feel like at a certain point, they'll just start, like, it doesn't seem like Judge is at 100% health, and there's probably a bunch of other guys who are not at 100% health. So I feel like there will come a point in, I don't know, maybe earlier, mid-September, where they start resting guys, because it's like, why run an injured Judge out there if he's just taking a risk that he's going to make his foot worse or whatever. So I feel like they will start like taking their foot off the gas pedal at a certain point and end up below. That's my half-baked prediction. How about you? What do you think?
Yeah, I agree. I would peg them around 79, if I had to guess, around 79 wins, 80, something like that. But yeah, I think that they'll end up slightly below for the same reason that she said.
Yeah. And I guess there's also like with guys like Rodon and Cortez who are trying to come back at a certain point, presuming they, you know, stay kind of outside the postseason picture, you can just be like, don't bother like trying to hurt yourself coming back. So,
right.
Yeah, unless they get like a really amazing hot streak and get right back in it, that would completely change the calculus. But yeah, that's my prediction. All right, so let's get to your questions. We put out the call for questions and got some from our listeners. So let's start with a question from Amar, who wants to know, how can the Cardinals get in shape this offseason in the hopes to return victorious in the NL Central?
Yeah, I mean, they're going to need to add pitching. They've been very clear about that. John Mozeliak said Monday afternoon that they're going to try to add three starters this offseason. Presumably, they won't all come from free agency. I would guess they'll probably try to sign two and then trade for one. But it makes sense. I mean, they traded away Flaherty and Montgomery. Wainwright's going to be a free agent. And if he were anyone besides Adam Wainwright, he would have been knocked out of the rotation by now because he's having a really bad final season. And so, you know, it's just they got Michaelis and maybe Matz. And beyond that, it's just, you know, it's Matthew Liberatore has been up and down, and Zach Thompson has been mostly a reliever at the major league level. And so they traded for upper minor starting pitching in the Flaherty and Montgomery trades. And when they traded Jordan Hicks to the Blue Jays, they got a couple upper minors pitching prospects, but they're going to need to add stability sort of to the middle of the staff. So I think that's going to be kind of where they really prioritize the offseason, because I do like the position player group still quite a bit and think that there's a good chance that they can get back to contending by next year if they had enough starting pitching.
Yeah, absolutely. There's still a bunch of great bats, like guys who can play multiple different positions, so you can move them around. Since we talked about you glossed over it a bit. What do you think is going to happen with Waino in the next few weeks? Do you think they let him? Like,
I think they'll let him. I don't see the point of taking him out. Like, are you going to move him to the bullpen? Are you going to designate him for assignment when you're 15 games under 500 or where they are? Like, I just, you know, obviously if they were competing this year, it's a different story. I think he would have already been at least bumped to the bullpen and maybe entirely off the roster. But it's a lost season anyways, and they need somebody to take the ball. And so, yeah, I think that they should probably just let Waino take another 8 or 9 starts. And I think he's still going for 200 wins too, right? He's fairly close to that, but
198. He's at 198.
Yeah. So like, I don't want to say they owe it to him, but I more or less think that they'll at least let him try to get to 200.
But yeah. Why not? Like you said, right? Like it's not like they're hurting their playoff chances or whatever. Right. So like, just let him go out there. I guess what might be interesting and would increase his chances of getting to 200 wins is like putting an opener in front of him. Do you think they would entertain that at all? Do you think his pride, like, is he, because he's like 42, is he like, no, I'm a starter? Do you think, because if you put him out there and like, you know, have somebody pitch the first two innings, then he pitches like innings 3 through 6, it increases his chances of getting a win. But do you think he might consider that like cheating or something?
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, I'm sure the front office and Wainwright and Ollie Marmol have kind of discussed that, because he's a prideful guy. And obviously, you know, when you have an ERA pushing 9, there's no way to sort of sugarcoat it. He hasn't been good, and I'm sure he knows that. And so as they get closer, and, you know, if he's sitting on 199 or something, and they're like, okay, here's where the best way that we think that we can get you to 200 and sort of mitigate the damage that you're taking out there, then maybe he accepts that kind of role. But it really depends. Like, I think you just kind of have to see whatever he's open to and sort of abide by what he wants, because again, like, there's just no incentive really for the team to anger him, because the overall season is going to be a disappointment no matter what happens.
Yeah. Well, why not see what happens? Okay, so the Cardinals definitely need pitching. You mentioned that they might sign some guys, but they might also trade some guys. We also have a question here from Doug, one of our listeners, who essentially asks if the Cardinals and the Mariners can line up on a trade. What are your thoughts there, Anthony?
That's been speculated upon, you know, going back months now. Just makes sense. I mean, Seattle's got a lot of young starting pitching. They want controllable hitters. It's sort of the opposite with St. Louis. I think that there's potentially a fit there, maybe with a Brian Wu or a Bryce Miller, and sort of the Nolan Gorman, Brendan Donovan tier of player. Like, I don't think that Dylan Carlson's getting any of the Seattle young starters. I don't think that Seattle would give up Gilbert or Kirby, you know, maybe for Jordan Walker or something like that. But I don't see why St. Louis would do that. And so I think that it's one of the kind of, I don't want to say back end starters for Seattle, because even Miller and Wu are very good. But sort of one of them for the kind of mid tier young player for St. Louis, young hitter for St. Louis.
Yeah, I can see a fit there. I mean, I was writing like Marco Gonzalez underwent season ending surgery this week, but he's supposed to be ready for spring training. So, you know, on paper, the Mariners have 7 starters going into next year, I believe, because you got like Castillo, Kirby, Gilbert, Gonzalez, Wu, Miller, and Hancock. And, you know, presumably Robbie Ray coming back at some point, because he underwent Tommy John in May. So presumably, unless he has some significant setback, he'll be back in the rotation by like June or July of next year. So they could certainly, you know, some of those guys have options and they could just keep them in the minors as depth. But, you know, they have holes in their lineup and could use one of those players from the Cardinals. So I can see it lining up there. But you're right that it comes down to valuation, because clearly the Mariners would prefer not to give up somebody like Kirby or Gilbert, who are well established as above average starting pitchers. So you don't want to lose those guys. So I guess it depends how much the Cardinals would be willing to give up for somebody like Wu or Miller or one of those guys.
Right. Yeah. I mean, I would probably, even if I were St. Louis, do Walker for Kirby, but I don't know that Seattle would do that at this point. I mean, Kirby looks so good. Yeah. Walker for Gilbert, I think, would be kind of an interesting framework. But you just very rarely see players that talented with that much control get swapped. Teams are just so reluctant to do that.
Well, we have another question here from Ben, who is asking about what the Diamondbacks need to do in the offseason. And I think they're another team that needs pitching. So that could be another one that fits with what we were just talking about. How do you feel about the Diamondbacks offseason?
Yeah, they're definitely going to need starting pitching. I mean, it would have been nice for them, obviously, if Brandon Pfaadt had kind of hit the ground running. Ryan Nelson has been okay, but not particularly good at the back end of the rotation. And so I imagine that those guys will get other chances next year, but you don't necessarily want to go in with a starting five of Galen, Merrill Kelly, Pfaadt, Nelson, and a Zach Davies type stopgap again. They'll have to shoot a little bit higher this time around. I think the infield probably is another area, especially third base. It's been kind of a revolving door there. Longoria's going to be a free agent, I believe, and they traded for Jace Peterson, who is on a 2-year deal, but he's not an everyday third baseman on a contender. He's more of a nice bench piece, rotational left-handed bat, but they should probably find some way to at least supplement the third base mix. But mostly starting pitching. I guess you can kind of look towards the bullpen as well, but rotation, I think, is the big need.
Okay, I think we have time for one more question here, which is Steven wants to know about Mitch Garver's free agency, whether his landing spots. You know, he has been taking over for Jonah Heim of late and doing pretty well. So are you interested in Mitch Garver this winter, Anthony?
This is an interesting one. I hadn't really considered Garver as a potential free agent. I mean, he is. I hadn't thought of him as a particularly interesting one, but the questioner, I think Steven, you said, he's right that Garver's having a really good year kind of in a rotational role and has stepped up as a number one catcher since Heim's been hurt. It's a very weak catching class. Garver's going to be 33, so you're probably looking at a 2-year deal, but he's arguably the best catcher available on next winter's free agent class. It's not a very good one. As far as teams that could sort of fit, I mean, Cleveland, I guess, depending on how they feel about Bo Naylor. Houston, I guess, same sort of thing. They've got Yiner Diaz, who's kind of a young offense first catcher. Maybe look to supplement it with Garver. Miami, again, is another team that's we've kind of talked about for going back to the deadline, just hasn't had a ton of production out of the position. So a few areas that I think Steven's right, that Garver could probably find a nice 2-year deal in land sort of a number one or 1A catching job somewhere else.
Yeah, I wonder if the Rays would be interested, because they seem to be willing to take a shot on guys with injury track records, which is the thing with Garver, right? Like, he hasn't played 70 games in a season since 2019. So, you know, somebody like Tampa, I feel like they could use help behind the plate. And, you know, they sign guys like Zach Eflin, and, you know, they'll acquire players from other teams that have injury track records, and they just seem willing to take those risks. And, you know, it kind of works when everybody's healthy, as we saw earlier in the year. And now they're kind of like dealing with it, as like so much of their rotation is on the injured list. But they're a kind of team that, because they don't spend on the top levels of free agency, those are the kind of like risk buys that they have to make. You see a fit there? Yeah.
Yeah, I like that fit too. Boston, sort of same general idea. They've shown some injury tolerance and have the Reese McGuire, Connor Wong platoon that's been okay, I guess, but you could upgrade over Connor Wong.
Yeah. And I guess Garver is even like, he's done some DHing, so he could, even if you have a couple catchers you like, as you know, Boston seems to like Wong and McGuire, but you know, you could fit Garver in there, if especially if Turner's gone and your DH spot is a little bit more open next year. But yeah, that'll be an interesting one. Mitch Garver's free agency this winter. All right. We are running out of time here, so we got to wrap it up. But another week of interesting baseball stuff. We are coming into, as we mentioned earlier, the off-season stuff. We will be gradually ramping up as it gets closer in the weeks to come. I just started this morning getting ready the arbitration projections, started doing some work on that. So, you know, the off season is heating up. I know you love those arbitration projections. So we'll be back next week with more talking about the season to come and the off season to come. And you can also get the analysis on MLBtraderumors.com, as you know, and you can get it in your inbox by signing up for the newsletter. And if you sign up for the front office package, it's a couple of bucks a month. You get rid of the ads and you get more stuff in your email. So go ahead and do that. You get all of the MLBTR content, and we will talk to you next week.
Thank you for listening to this week's podcast. Remember to visit MLBTradeRumors.com and follow us on Twitter at MLBTradeRumors.